Most High, I come to you giving you thanks and praise for keeping me in sound body and mind. I ask you to forgive me for all my indiscretions, all that I have done and all that I will do. I ask you to open me up, use me as your vessel, let my voice be yours. Speak your mission through me, allow the listeners to open up and receive it the way you intended. No holds barred. Use me. I look at the news and I watch other people's nations formed over.
So, welcome once again to Ubuntu Radio, our podcast, and we're on the road today talking to a gentleman that I actually been wanted to speak to for a long, long time. His name is Chatfield Kent, and we're in Leland, North Carolina, just outside of Wilmington. And we made the journey today because this man is worth the journey, the hours, and just to hear him speak. I first saw Mr. Kent. He was a major part of a documentary that everybody, and I've talked about Wilmington on Fire before. I had the director Christopher Everett on a podcast episode a while back, but Mr. Chatfield Kent was really, I mean, maybe he'll say it, he's the impetus for some of the information, the facts that came to light, who spurred on and made the movie or the documentary Wilmington on Fire possible. So we're going to talk about that and just some of the things that he mentioned this week on Facebook. We've become Facebook friends, and he mentioned a story just offhand about having to put a gun to somebody's head to defend. But we're going to get to it. We're going to get to all that. It's just that interesting. But, you know, the word raconteur, just somebody who is a good storyteller, that's the vibe I get from Mr. Kent, and he's lived a life that's worth telling and retelling, and there's stories and lessons to be learned from it. I mean, he just told me a story about his father clocking a man in the face because he mentioned the N-word in his presence. So this is the kind of person we're dealing with, a man who understands the fabric of this country, understands human nature, and we want to get some information from him about how he became that way and what he sees in America and the world today, because, you know what I'm saying, Dos Equis ended their campaign about the most interesting man in the world, and to me, this man is one of the most interesting people that I know. So we're gonna find out some more today about Mr. Chatfield Kent. So stick around. There's a whole lot more. There's a whole lot more coming. I want to start off again talking about Wilmington on Fire. And again, it's a documentary about the massacre that happened in Wilmington, November 11th, 1898. Black folks were just gunned down. But I mean, how did you sort of get involved? Because you play a major role in the film. How did you sort of give the people just a little bit of background on Wilmington on Fire and kind of your entrance into that whole process?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on.
No problem.
You know, on your show.
Thank you. Thank you.
I like to spread the message. My family originally was from up north. They were from Connecticut, and they moved to North Carolina about a year before I was born. And
what year?
1962 is okay. When they moved here.
Okay.
And my family fought for the Union. We used to go back to Connecticut every year when I was a kid, and we would go to his grave in Riverside Cemetery in Waterbury, Connecticut. They've got a 19-foot bronze statue on top of his grave. His name was Colonel John Lyman Chatfield. He was the Corps Commander during the Civil War for the 6th Connecticut Volunteers and the 54th Colored Massachusetts.
From Glory?
From the movie Glory.
Wow.
My great-great-grandfather led that charge as a historical fact. He was killed in the attack.
The Matthew Broderick character from Glory?
No, that was the colonel for the 54th Massachusetts.
Okay.
My great-great-grandfather was the colonel for the 6th Connecticut Volunteers,
okay,
which was on the left of the 54th Massachusetts during that attack.
Gotcha.
On Fort Wagner. My great-great-grandfather was shot twice, and he died a month later from white lead poisoning, also known as gangrene. But the commander of the 54th was killed in the fort, and the Confederates buried him with his troops.
Gotcha.
But my great-great-grandfather was actually rescued out of the fort and was returned to Waterbury and died from his injuries.
Gotcha.
What really got me started on researching 1898 was when I was 7 years old. I lived in Bayshore Estates, which is out by, it's north of Wilmington, off of Highway 17. It's between Highway 17 and the ocean. And during the Civil War, the Confederates had a supply fort out there. Okay, it was just wasn't really a fort. It was just an encampment. But in any event, when I was 7 years old, we were out in those woods playing army. And I found the unmarked grave of a Confederate soldier. And I brought his leg bone home. I thought it was a horse bone. I brought his leg bone home and showed it to my father. And my father said, that's not a horse bone. That's a man's leg bone. So the sheriff's department came out and they dug all night. They couldn't find anything. So then the coroner said, look, this bone's over 100 years old. You're not looking for a murder scene. You're looking for a grave, basically. And so they turned it over to the museum. So the museum came out and they searched for a couple days. They couldn't find the guy's grave. So I went back out there and I dug up the whole Confederate soldier, including his coffin, pieces of his uniform, his belt buckle, his buttons. He was buried in his uniform. 7 years old. So I turned all that stuff over to the museum and they wrote an article about it in the Star News newspaper. And the guys from the Wilmington Light Infantry read that article and they summoned me to the Wilmington Light Infantry. And they wanted to know where that grave was at. So I took them out there and showed them where the grave was. They went through their records and they identified the guy. His name was Lieutenant White. He was killed in a skirmish with federal troops in May of 1865. And that was his farm and his family buried him on that farm. So then that pretty much got me into the Wilmington Light Infantry. Because not only had I found the grave, I'd actually held the bones of one of their hallowed members.
So give the people a little background. What's the Wilmington Light Infantry?
The Wilmington Light Infantry was formed in the late 1850s as a state militia. It was kind of like backup for the police, for the sheriff. Because the sheriff, you'd have a sheriff and maybe one deputy. But if they really needed to go looking for somebody, say you had somebody that went on a murdering rampage, they would call out the state guard, the militia, and these guys would come out. They would hunt down the fugitive, catch them, turn them over to the sheriff, and then those guys would all go home. They were today's National Guard, basically. And if we got into a war, like a national war, these would be the first troops the president would call up. When they would call for volunteers. See, we are constitutionally prohibited from maintaining an army over 10,000 men. We still are. That is why the United States stays in perpetual war, because it justifies constitutionally us maintaining an army over 10,000 men. Read the original United States Constitution. And that provision has never, ever been struck down or declared unconstitutional. We just usurp that constitutional provision in our original constitution by just staying in a perpetual state of war.
Wow.
You know, the only time the United States has been in peace has been from 1865 to 1898. Ever since April of 1898, we declared war on Spain. We have literally been in a perpetual state of war ever since. And we have maintained an army in excess of 10,000 men since April of 1898. Look at our history before that. You will see we never maintained an army and navy over 10,000 men prior to April of 1898. And that is when President McKinley declared war on Spain, and Spain declared war on us, and we raised this big, huge army, and that's who pulled off the coup in 1898 in North Carolina, was the 1st and 2nd North Carolina Infantry Regiments, which had been raised to go to war with Spain. They came home 30 days before the coup on leave and pulled off the coup.
Represent the death. Cows that all your enemies wanna shoot you down. They got then a bunch of
and the automatic weapons that produce the pals. Word on the streets, they all got heaters. They gon' hit you up, you ain't even gon' see it. You got a lot of money, I ain't tryna be funny, but they say where you're going, you ain't even gon' need it. They see you round round shining with your fine round diamonds, pretty green eye lady. Been on the sideline, popping while you prime time, popping hot pop on a piece of your pastry. I suggest you protect your bakery, cause they coming for your head, and it's a bounty on the chain that's hanging from your neck. You see,
I don't know what you've been told in your ear, but I hear it's going down. Somebody gotta know what you've been told in your ear, but where's it going round? Somebody gotta
hit it with the strap, clap, in it.
So, I mean,
that's that's unpublished history, by the way. You're getting this.
Wow.
You know.
So again,
and I have the records, by the way,
for people who don't, for people who may not, because again, the coup that happened in, well, the massacre. Let's be honest, the massacre that happened on November 11th, 1898, in Wilmington, unknown scores of black folks killed, and this is why my friend, I have a friend here, Miss DJ, who saw the documentary Wilmington on Fire, and she's got some questions about. For you, we're going to get to those later, about the reasoning behind the coup. Was it racial? Was it political? Was it economic? So there's a lot of information here, and I hope anybody who hears us goes and watches, buys the film Wilmington on Fire, goes online and downloads it, and watch it to get some background about some of the things that Mr. Kent just mentioned. But just, again, prior to April of 1898, there was not a standing army, if you would, in the United States. So an army was created for the purpose of fighting Spain. So we have these soldiers prepped and ready. Also, 30 years, and we're going to get into it, 30 years after the Civil War, they're not particularly happy with what is going on in Wilmington in terms of their privilege and their place. So we have all this sort of almost manic energy waiting for people to do something to release it. So we're at 1898 in Wilmington. And we segued into that by talking about Mr. Kent finding the bones of a soldier who was part of this Wilmington Light Infantry. So we're going to get back to that. So the Wilmington Light Infantry, April 1898, they're in, obviously, Wilmington. They're prepped and ready to go for war with Spain. Nothing's happening. So what is happening in Wilmington, April, May, June of 1898?
Well, of course, in January of 1898, USS Maine blew up in Havana Harbor. Mm-hmm. And it basically said it was a bomb. We know today that it was a coal fire within the ship that blew the ship up. But they didn't have the technology back then to have come to that conclusion. So around April of 1898, the Naval Board came to the conclusion that a mine had been placed on the ship and it had been blown up by Spain, mm-hmm. by the Spanish, who occupied Cuba at the time. And so by April of 1898, President McKinley ordered a blockade of Cuba. That is an act of war. So Spain declared war on the United States. Well, we reciprocated and declared war on Spain. Then President McKinley called upon the states to raise a standing army of 125,000 men. All right? Well, of course, the states immediately turned to the state guards because those were your only military men mm-hmm. in the United States. We had not been at war 33 years, okay? So really, the only people that had any type of military experience within the United States were these state militias and the very few soldiers that we did have who were doing the stuff with the Indians and everything, okay. Massacres and stuff like that. Okay, you did have a few troops there, but you really didn't have a standing army. So McKinley called for 125,000 volunteers. Over 1 million people volunteered for the war with Spain in the United States. So here they had an overwhelming response to this war call. They called for 125,000 men. They raised 1 million. All right. Well, North Carolina raised 3 regiments, the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd North Carolina Infantry Regiments. All right. In 1898, the military was segregated. So they formed the 1st and 2nd Infantry Regiments, and then the 3rd Colored Infantry Regiment. All right, because they had a lot of black men that were volunteering for the military too. So they put them in a separate regiment. All right. Well, they moved the 3rd North Carolina Infantry Regiment, which was your colored regiment, to Fort Macon, North Carolina, which is on the Outer Banks. This fort had been abandoned at that point since about 1868. So it had been empty for 30 years. And it was a concrete block fort, is what it was. The two white North Carolina infantry regiments, they marched them into service in Raleigh at Camp Granger, I think is what it was called, which is now the North Carolina State Fairgrounds. Now, if you read the Goldsboro Argus newspaper from May of 1898, when those two white North Carolina infantry regiments marched into camp to be mustered into U.S. service in May of 1898, they marched in wearing Confederate uniforms. This was 33 years after the end of the war was over, and these 2,000 troops marched into that camp wearing Confederate uniforms. And most of them were like 21, 22, 23 years old.
So they
old.
Had no idea.
They weren't even born when the war ended. Where did these uniforms come from?
So what we're getting at is that the sentiment is still there. The war is not over. I mean, we're in a state of perpetual war now, but the war between the states, so to speak, was not over.
Okay. The Confederacy never surrendered, okay? The Confederate armies surrendered. But the Confederate government itself never surrendered.
It begs the question, have they ever?
The state of North Carolina, a lot of people don't know this, from 1864 to 1868, the state of North Carolina produced 125,000 Confederate uniforms. They were still making Confederate uniforms in North Carolina for 3 years after the war ended. There's still over 100,000 of them stored in a warehouse outside of Fayetteville, North Carolina, to this day. So then people ask the question, well, why didn't the 3rd North Carolina Infantry Regiment, the colored guys, they were armed, trained, mustered, regimented, they were organized, they were ready to go. Why didn't they intervene in the coup? I'm getting ready to tell you why. On September 14th, 1898, the white government union moved the 3rd North Carolina Infantry Regiment from Fort Macon, North Carolina to Knoxville, Tennessee. And they stuck them 3 miles north of Knoxville out in the middle of nowhere. And when I say the middle of nowhere, that's where they got the term from. And the place where they were at today is called Middleton, Tennessee. That's how far out in the middle of nowhere it is. And listen to this. There was 1,043 troops colored in that regiment, all right? They put them in a box 3 yards wide by 400 yards long and told them, if you step out of that box, we're going to court-martial and execute you for desertion. Okay, now let's take 3 yards by 400 yards. Sounds kind of big, doesn't it? All right, well, that's 9 feet by 1,200 feet. And they put 1,043 men in there. All right, so these guys, they kept them there until mid-October, and then they shipped them from Knoxville, Tennessee to Macon, Georgia. And they stuck them right out in, again, in the middle of nowhere. They didn't even have fresh water. So then they started digging a water line from a former Confederate's privately owned water company out to their camp, which was 3 miles away. So they had these United States volunteer colored troops who volunteered for the War of Spain. okay, to go and dig up water lines for a Confederate down in Georgia, all right? When they mustered the 1st and 2nd North Carolina Infantry Regiment out of service, they did it in November and December of 1898. But they did it in North Carolina. They returned the soldiers to their home state, and they mustered them out of U.S. service in their home state. The 3rd North Carolina Colored Infantry Regiment, they kept them in Macon, Georgia until February of 1899, building them daggone water lines. Told them if they went outside of their 3-yard by 400-yard box, they were getting shot. You're talking 10 square feet per man. That's to eat, urinate, sleeping quarters, eating quarters, latrine, medical, and where your tent set up. These guys had to sleep in shifts. And that way these guys would have somewhere to sleep. So they built the water line. They didn't return them to North Carolina and muster them out of service. They mustered them out of service in Macon, Georgia, 2 states away from where they were inducted into U.S. service. Then they had to make their way through Georgia and South Carolina to get to North Carolina. And the racist crap was going on all through South Carolina and Georgia all of that time. I can't find any of the members of the 3rd North Carolina Infantry Regiment. I don't think any of them made it home from Macon, Georgia when they were released in February of 1899. I think they were all lynched on their way home. I've been down on the rock for so long, so long.
So we want to get back to, again, where the bones, literally the bones of history lead us. And your entry in the story about the Wilmington Massacre of black folks in 1898. So we have a little prescript about what happened, sort of the atmosphere. And rightfully, anybody who knows this story can go, well, if there was an army, maybe 1,000 deep of trained black soldiers, why didn't they do something? One, well, they probably would have been killed by the time they got there.
That's right.
But just to give people who may not know and haven't seen Wilmington on fire yet. So we're talking about April 1898, war declared on Spain. Or was it February 1898?
It was April.
So April, war declared on Spain. Perpetual state of war. We're ready to go do something. Obviously, we understand 30 years after the Civil War, we've hinted at the fact that there's still uniforms being produced. So the sentiment is still there. Maybe on paper. There's been an armistice and a truce, but there, like Mr. Kent said, we're in a perpetual state of war in this country, and there certainly seemed to be the case, and probably still in existence, between the North and the South, and the people still have that idea. So we have people in Wilmington who have not surrendered, and we have in Wilmington at the time a prospering port full of black folks at every level of society, from lawyers, politicians, assemblymen, from almost state legislature level, all the way down to yeomen working the docks. And so you have these folks with still this Confederate ideology who are looking at these black folks going, look, I know we just freed y'all. We didn't free y'all. The Northerners freed y'all. But you're still under our governance or in our way. Yeah. So what did they decide to do come November 11th, 1890, for the people who haven't seen the movie?
The way the white people back then really looked at the black man, as far as the South goes, they looked at the black man as property that had been stolen from them by the Yankees. And as such, anything that the black man owned really belonged to the white man. that was, you know, why I say in the film that I think this had a lot more to do with economics than as much as with race. I think they saw their economic superiority slipping to the point that they were not going to be superior anymore if they didn't take drastic actions to reestablish what they considered an acceptable social order.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that's basically what they did. They created a class system, much like what they had in South Africa during apartheid, mm-hmm. What they had in Nazi Germany. You know, there's many examples of this through history. And that's basically, you know, what they did. What got me involved was, you know, after I found that bone and I got into the Wilmington Light Infantry Building, I was allowed access to their records. And I used to go in there when I was a teenager, and I was just fascinated with the Civil War. And that's really what I was studying while I was going in there, was their regimental histories of all the battles that they fought during the Civil War. But then later I started getting into the War of Spain,
mm-hmm.
you know, their deployments there and the coup. And they actually talk about it in their records. I didn't really realize what I was reading at the time, but later in life I came to realize, you know, as I learned more about 1898, that I'd read about this.
Destroy all black folks, annihilating their status and community, fracturing both their socioeconomic and political.
So when the state created the Race Riot Commission,
I'm sorry, it was in the 90s?
93.
Okay.
They wrote an article about it in the newspaper, and I remember showing it to my wife, and I laughed about it. I said, they're not going to find anything. They're going to go through all this money. They're going to announce that everybody's dead, records missing, you know, we give up.
So,
know.
Just to go back, so the state of North Carolina finally sort of, under pressure, admitted that something happened in Wilmington in 1898,
yeah.
and there was a commission set up to ostensibly find out what happened.
An investigative research okay. commission.
Okay, in 1993, okay.
Yes. 1993. And I read the article, and I remember laughing. I showed it to my wife, and I said, they're not going to find anything. I said, they'll go through all this public money, and they'll just give up. Watch. But they'll get all the names in the paper and the pictures in the mm-hmm. paper and smile for the cameras and everything. In October of 2003, 10 years later, I picked up the paper one morning, and sure enough, here's the article. From the 1898 Race Riot Commission, we give up. Everybody's dead. The records are all missing. Nobody's ever going to find out the truth about what happened. So we're disbanding the commission. There's not going to be a report. I showed it to my wife. I said, see, I told you. Okay. I said, watch this. Folded up the paper, picked up the phone, made one telephone call. Said, yeah, would you ask this person to give me a call? Hung up. Hour later, the phone rang, and they said, what are you looking for? And I said, you know exactly what I'm looking for. Where they at? And she goes, I read that article in the paper this morning, and I knew if anybody was going to call, it would be you. And she told me where the records were at, and that was it. Next day, I had the records that she saw in the film. And it was just that easy to find. It just took somebody from Wilmington who was willing to do it.
Papery murder, black on black murder. Papery murder, black on black murder.
Yeah. This is to the memory of Dan Roy Henry. Too much enemy fire to catch a friend. Strays from the same shade, nigga, we on the same team. Giving you respect, I expect the same thing. All black everything, nigga, you know my fresh coat. My fight for you, don't increase my stress though. Niggas watching the throne, very happy to be you. Power to the people, when you see me, see you.
And I'm from the murder capital, where they murder for capital.
Heard about at least 3 killings this afternoon. Looking at the news like them, I was just with them after school. No shop class, but had the school got a tool. And I could die any day type attitude. Plus his little brother got shot repping his avenue. It's time for us to stop and redefine black power. 41 souls murdered in 50 hours.
The paper read murder. Black on black murder. The paper read murder. Black on black murder.
What records was the state looking for that you found and you knew where they were?
I found a detailed, documented record of a conspiracy to commit a coup. And it consisted of the names of the people who were actively involved, many of their positions, and how they organized it, and how long they spent on it. This wasn't something that was just spontaneous that they drew up the day before they did it. These guys had been planning this for months, if not for a couple of years. I found evidence that it went back, that the idea to do it went back actually a couple of years. But they didn't really have the men under arms to actually pull this off until 1898. Plus, they had to do a little bit of jockeying about getting people into proper political positions. These positions would give them power to be able to do something about it.
Gotcha.
Okay, so they wiggled their right people into the right place at the right time to pull this off. And that's what Wilmington on Fire showed. Some of it. You'll see a lot more in Wilmington on Fire, too. You know, we've got a lot more information that we could not fit into Wilmington on Fire 1. We got as much in there as we could, but,
gotcha.
You know, there's a lot more to this story.
Success never smells so sweet. I stink of success, the new black elite. They say my black car bear the mark of the beast. I repeat, my religion is the beat. My verse is like church, my Jesus.
And I've done extensive research on this. You know, you see what I do. I'm a farmer. You know, I'm retired, and I've got the time to work on this.
And we're going
to
talk about that because that's what I find interesting. You're not a so-called trained researcher, but you did this because honestly, it was the right thing to do. You know where the information was, and almost as a sin not to reveal it because exists.
That's right.
They couldn't find it, or. Let's be honest, they didn't want to find it. They didn't want to make the truth known, but you knew it had to be done.
And I'll tell you right here now, this fact alone proves that the state was not trying to find what happened in 1898. When I found these records in October of 2003, the Race Riot Commission had not even met for 2.5 years. I don't know what they were looking for, but they hadn't even met for 2.5 years. So the records you saw in the film, it took me 27 days to unravel the entire crime from its inception to them pulling it off. And that includes identifying everybody that was involved in it. I did it in 27 days. And I took a suitcase. In fact, there's right in the room next door, full of records. And I walked into Mayor Harper Peterson's office, mayor of the city of Wilmington. And he was on the Race Riot Commission. And he was running for re-election. And the election was in like 4 or 5 days. Okay. And so I walked into his office with a suitcase. And I've known Harper at that point for about, I guess, right at about 30 years. Okay, since he first moved to Wilmington, all right, and I walked into his office, and I sat down, and he goes, oh, so they're finally running you out of town, huh, because I had a suitcase with me, and I laughed and said, not quite yet, Harper, but they might after this, and I asked him, I said, how's your wife, how's your kids, how's your business, how's the city doing, how's the 1898 Race Riot Commission? he tells me, oh, we're disbanding. We haven't met in 2.5 years and blah, blah, blah. Everybody's dead. We're never going to find the records. They're all missing. You know, we're disbanding the commission. We're never going to write a report. I said, well, hold up the train for just a second here, Harper. And I picked up that suitcase and I set it on the mayor's desk and I opened it up and I said, here's all the records y'all can't find. And this is how they did it, Harper. Boom, 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 record after record. And I said, and this is who did it, and this is how they did it. Oh, by the way, Harper, how much money did the legislature give y'all to research this event in the last 10 years? He said, nothing. I said, really? Your budget was zero. What, they give you a blank check? He said, no. They didn't even give us gas money to come to the Race Riot Commission meetings. They didn't give us any money, nothing. I said, well, how many researchers and stuff like that, interns and people from the state archives did they give you to help the commissioners do this research, to search for these records? None. They gave them no researchers. They gave them no interns. They didn't even give them gas money. I said, well, gosh, no wonder you guys couldn't find this stuff. I said, now let me ask you another question, Mayor Peterson. Didn't the 1898 North Carolina Race Riot Commission meet several times in the library of the Lower Cape Fear Historical Society, the Latimer House? He said, yeah. I said, don't you live right across the street from there? He said, yes, I do. I said, you know, I found these records in the room right above that library. I said, you know, to tell you the truth, Harper, I think the records could have fell through the ceiling, bounced off of you commission members' heads, laid out on the table in chronological order right in front of you, and y'all still wouldn't have found it. Because you weren't looking for it. All you was looking for was to get your name in the newspaper so you could raise some money for your next re-elect me campaign. You're a lifetime politician, just like everybody on that commission is, and that's why you guys didn't find what I found. And it took me 27 days.
And his response?
Yep, I'm calling the commission together. That's it. They met about a week later in the mayor's office, and that's when I blew their mind.
Now while you gritting your teeth, frustration, baby, you got to breathe. Take a lot more than you to get rid of me. You see, I do what they can't do. I just do me. Ain't no stress when it comes to stage. Get what you see. Meet me in the lab, pen and pad. Don't believe. 16's mine. Create my own line.
So are you a de facto member of the commission? You're the
Basically,
or this is your own commission work. This
yeah,
is your
I, own commission. I basically told them to get out of the way.
Basically, Wilmington on Fire is the commission work.
Yeah.
Christopher Everett's film is the commission.
That's right. I did their work. Christopher Everett and I did the work of the 1898 Race Riot Commission. Because
shame.
They did not do it. Okay. They're lucky I don't send them a bill for $500,000. That's what my research is worth. That's what I was offered for. And I turned it down.
From the state?
No. I was offered by a business investment group out of Chapel Hill. Offered me $500,000 for my research.
You think they had nefarious reasons to keep that shit quiet?
They were going to bury it. Because I asked them, I said, what are you going to do with it? And they told me it's none of my business. I said, before I sell it to you, yeah, it is my business. What are you going to do with it? And they said, we're going to, you know, whatever we do with it is our business. I said, well, that's the wrong answer. No. And I gave it to Chris forever.
I mean, you're preaching the gospel of Wilmington on Fire. I preach it as much as possible. Again, I have a friend, she watched it with me, and she had some questions for you based on something you said about the major reason behind the coup, the massacre of 1898, November 11th, was economic. And I'm going to let her come in at this point and say her piece.
Okay. So you mentioned in the film, and you mentioned here, that you didn't necessarily feel like it was as much about race as it was about economics. But I struggled with that, because if that same money that was being made by white men, then this wouldn't have happened. So how is it not about race?
Well, in my research, what I found is it was more of an attempt to destroy the populist party. I think that both political parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, viewed the populace as a threat.
Why?
Because the populace were made up of poor white people primarily. Mm-hmm. And they had some black members too. And they were actually, population-wise, a much larger demographic than the rich white or even rich black people were. There were a lot more poor people in America back then than there were rich people.
Okay.
And so, and also in the course of doing my research, yes, race did play a factor in it, but there were also white people who were robbed and murdered and exiled also. You know, populist. I mean, people who weren't going to go along with the Democrats. You know, they got killed too. So I think that it was, and then their property got stolen.
But they had the option. So they had the option, I would imagine, to align with the Democrats, where black people didn't have that option.
That's right.
Which brings it right back to race.
That's right. That's true. And it's, you know, and I may be wrong. You know, it's my opinion. I know race did play a part in it, and it was a major part, but really I think it was more of a way to instantly enrich themselves and to regain political power for eternity. And, you know, my research just doesn't stop on November 10th. You know, I went in the decades after that to mm-hmm. see what these people did to our laws, our constitutions, our people. You know, well, what did they do to cement white supremacy? And so, you know, I just don't go upon the shooting that happened on November 10th and coming to that conclusion as much as I go with what they did afterwards also, with the wholesale looting, many of the laws they enacted. And it wasn't just against black people, it was against white people too. You know, they enacted laws that if you were a poor white, you couldn't vote. Okay, that's disenfranchising. And it has nothing to do with race, it has to do with economic status. Okay, so that kind of plays into my thinking here. But, you know, as far as the way they jumped off on November 10th, yeah, it was race. On that day, it was race. But I think there were underlying economic drivers and power drivers that gave them the impetus to do that. So when I make an opinion in Wilmington on Fire about, I don't really think it was as much about race as it was about money. You know, it's when I look at what they did that day, yeah, it was about race that day. But then afterwards, the stuff they did afterwards really was more about cementing their hold on power and enriching themselves. You know, and when we made the film, I think Christopher recorded me, I don't know, 7 or 8 times. He's probably got 24 hours of footage of just me, you know, talking about, you know, a lot of this, because I've done so much research. I mean, I'll be 54 in July. I've been researching this since I was 7 years old. I don't think there's another person on this planet who could even catch up to me as far as it goes at this point. You know, it's I pass on my knowledge and I give it to people mm-hmm. for free. And hopefully somebody else will pick up the torch and keep running with it, because there's so much more to know. And, you know, every time I go looking, I find more records about this. You know, it's now it's like second nature.
So as a seven-year-old, obviously there's natural curiosity spurred on by this actual thing that happened. Somebody didn't say write an essay. This actually, you actually held the bones.
Yeah.
So were you always curious and into, I want to find out a little bit more?
Oh, I've always been inquisitive, okay. You know, as far as, you know, wanting to look for things. You know, before we did the interview, you know, I showed you that I look for gold and silver all the time. And when I say I look for it, I mean, I actually look for it. And every time I look for it, and my wife can even verify this, Christopher Everett can verify it. Every time I look for it, I find it. And usually for free or for pennies. I'm a treasure hunter. Really is what I am. I'm a treasure hunter. It's just I happen to be good at it. And when I found those records about 1898, I was treasure hunting. I found a treasure trove. We showed the movie a couple weeks ago at Williston. I was outside treasure hunting. I found that gold earring, you know. I took my kid to the dentist the other day. I went next door to the thrift shop. I was treasure hunting. I found that sterling silver bracelet. You know, I'm a treasure hunter. And I'm just, you know, I know what I'm looking for. And I just happen to be good at it. They ain't ready for me. I'm
a dangerous man with some money in my pocket. Keep up. You just heard part one of my interview with Mr. Chatfield Kent. Come on back for the next episode of Ubuntu Radio, where we'll continue the conversation to find out more about this hidden treasure. What's